everybody. This is William Del Pilar. This is the Red, White, and Rude, where pop culture and politics collide. Today, we will discuss and debate the question, should the Menendez brothers be released back into society? We'll also talk about the death of late night television. Oh, Johnny Carson, wherefore art thou? For those of you who can remember Johnny Carson, greatest late night talk show host ever. Then we'll say our goodbyes to character actor Alan Rackins. And the problem, you probably don't know who he is, but you will once you see the picture. That's how it is with a lot of character actors. So before we move on, do not forget to like, share, and subscribe to this podcast of Red, White, and Rude, as well as our other podcasts that you can find on grumbleesmedia.com, as well as YouTube, Rumble, Apple, Spotify, and Pandora. All right. The Menendez brothers, brutal murders, dark secrets, and yet a new hope for freedom amidst claims of abuse. There you go, the Menendez brothers. If you look at those two pictures in the bottom left corner, that's how they look now. As you can see, Lyle Menendez is bald and proud. That's a big story issue and the straw that broke the camel's back. You see the picture in the top left, that's them. When they were in court, they would show up to court in their prison gear. And they would change. As you see them in the top right-hand corner of the big picture, that's the sweater look. The bottom middle ones, how they look in the suit. And the bottom right one is a picture of them younger and happier. You know, they weren't really great kids. You know, they were rich, spoiled kids who did murder their parents in cold blood. So Eric and Lyle, look at the big picture. Lyle is the one in the brown sweater. Eric is the one in the light green one there. So this case gained notoriety back in the 1990s. It was brutal, horrific. It was a cold-blooded murder of their parents, Jose and Kitty Menendez. I had Mary here, but Kitty was her name. Obviously, Kitty's a nickname. Maybe Mary was her actual name. But their case captivated the public because of the shocking nature of the crime and the subsequent trials. This was the big case before OJ. This is what kind of changed how the law was seen and applied to individuals of richness, celebrities, etc. You know, so they, let's see. Let's take a look at the parents. The parents, you know, it's a good looking family. If you look at the bottom picture there, you can see the resemblance between Jose and Eric. And then you can actually see the resemblance between Lyle and the mother. And the most famous pic is one in the top left corner there. That's that portrait. You see it in miniseries. You see it in series, in documentaries. In the miniseries, they always line up the actors in a similar pose. And then there's a couple other poses. There's a pose there of them real young back in the day. So after the horrific murder, there was a lavish spending spree following the murders of the parents. And then Eric began to feel overwhelming guilt. And that ultimately led to the exposure of the crime. So despite the shocking nature of the case, they weren't convicted. Despite everything I said early on, they were not convicted until their second trial. And at the end of that trial, they received life sentences without parole. Now, however, there are new developments in their case, and it may offer them a chance at freedom as they seek to have their sentences reconsidered. The judge can throw it out, or the judge can go, I'm reducing it. And if they reduce it at a certain point in prison life, you're sentenced to X amount of years. After a certain amount of years, you can be up for parole if you're a good convict. And many believe that if he goes 50 years, I reduce it from life to 50 years, they'll be up for parole and they'll get out. So let's review the crime and trials when they're and why they're in the news and the new evidence that could overturn the jury's decision. There's the murder scene. One of the most infamous murder scenes in the history of murders. So the night is August 20th, 1989. A dark night. Yet beautiful California weather. They went in with guns ablazing. Pop, 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 pop. Shotguns. Boom, 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 boom. And as you can see in that top right, that is the main shot of the murder scene. Let me go over here. Over here, you can't see it over here, but you see the cursor there. That's where Kitty was. See how the blood, and the father was over here, as you can see right here. Yeah, I think this is coffee table. It looks like a hand, though. It's hard to tell. Brutal murder. I mean, shot him in the head. I mean, there was at that angle, you can't tell, but probably a big gaping hole there. And obviously, here the body's being taken out. And very brutal, very brutal. A lot of blood. Now, here's a kicker. Most people look at that. That ain't so bad. Why? Because you're conditioned to look at movies with horrific blood-soaked scenes, video games that are so real now, horrific blood everywhere. But that's a very bloody scene. It's a very brutal murder. So the initial investigation was suspicious from the start. Their behavior post-crime included discovering that they purchased shotguns just 2 days before the murder, and then they used fake IDs to buy them. That set the scene for their eventual downfall, despite their claims. Then there was the extravagant spending. Following the murders, Eric and Lyle spent about $700K, including a $60,000 Porsche and a $550,000 cafe. He bought a business. $550,000, I believe, was the down payment. Now, when you just think about $60,000 Porsche, you're looking and thinking, oh, I ain't so much. The Porsche they bought is about $150,000-$200,000 today. So we're talking some cha-ching in terms of wealth being spent. $700,000. The family was worth about $10 to $12 million, if I remember correctly. And back then, that was a lot of money. Now, with the printing press, the way our society is, he's just another millionaire. But back then, he was a high-end millionaire. You know, it was in the era where, again, the printing press really had not caught up to where we're at today. So what led to their downfall was a confession to a therapist. The breakthrough, as people call it, the breakthrough in the investigation came when Eric confessed to his therapist, L. Jerome Mazzio, about the murders during the therapy session. That set up their fall, because Mazzio was not the most ethical, if you can't say, therapist. He slept with his patients. One of his patients was his mistress named Judalon Smite, and she reported Eric's confession to the police in March of 1990 after Mazzio spurned her. You know, it's just mind-boggling, to be quite frank. It's just simply put mind-boggling at the thought that a spurned woman, a scorned woman, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. And that eventually is what did those boys in. Well, what did them in was the pangs of guilt Eric was feeling, because they would have probably gotten away with it. So once they found out, the L.A. County District Attorney's Office charged both brothers with 2 counts of first-degree murder, and that was based on all the evidence gathered from their confessions and the behavior following the crime. And first-degree murder could bring the death penalty, so that was on the table. The first trial was in 1993, and it ended in a mistrial due to the hung jury. As most of you know, jurors were split between first degree and the lesser charges, such as manslaughter. The defense presented the claims of long-term sexual abuse by their father, Jose Menendez. But the prosecution argued that the brothers killed their parents for financial gain, and they had legitimacy in that argument for the simple fact, the spending spree, buying a business, tennis lessons, traveling the world, wanting to be a pro player. I mean, they were living large. They can come out and say, hey, we were just trying to drown our sorrows. I can believe that out of Eric, because he was an ignorant moron who confessed to his therapist, which is what blew all this in the open, but not Lyle. So the second trial was in 95, 96. It began in October, and there were significant changes in the approach to the evidence. The judge did not allow certain things in, specifically the defense's claim of abuse, as because they were saying, hey, it's an abuse excuse. Meaning back then, it was a theory that this only happened to girls, not the boys. Even as a young teenager, I was like, you gotta be kidding me. A boy can be abused. My logic could not fathom that. You're saying boys can be abused? Yes, they can. So the first trial had two juries. So people get confused, think of three trials. But the first trial had two juries. This trial only had one jury and excluded much of the defense's evidence, as I just stated, that related to the abuse. So throughout both trials, the jury perception did play a crucial role. In the first trial, the boys were great on the stand talking about their sexual abuse with the tears. I've been abused. He was great on the stand. But what caused part of their demise in the second trial was the fact that he was on the phone talking to somebody saying, I'll lie on the stand if I need to. You know, first jury did not know that. They weren't allowed to bring it in, or rather that kept him from being on the stand in the second trial because he would have been asked, well, did you say this? We have you on recording. Yes, you did say it. So he was kind of screwed. So the first trial, the jurors were conflicted, unable to reach a verdict due to the emotional testimonies about the abuse. The second trial, because that evidence was suppressed or limited, the jurors were more easily swayed. They were very easily swayed. They ended up not receiving the death sentence, as we all know, is obvious now, and they received life sentences without parole. See, this is what bothers me. You know, you hear that a lot. Then you hear it when the guy's up for parole. You're like, come on, man. So, the prosecution did their job, got him convicted by showing that their desire for wealth was a reality versus what they claimed was a fear for their safety. They thought the parents were going to off them. That's hogwash from the get-go. So what has made this movement so popular today? Why are these young men in the news? Well, there's been a TikTok movement. It's more throughout Instagram, TikTok, and social media, but they call it the TikTok movement. And a Netflix limited series and documentary. So here is an image of the boys. But it's not the boys. It's the family. It's a Netflix limited series. Those are the actors. Let me do this. In the top right corner. In fact, here's what I will do. Give me 1 second here. All right. I wanted to bring the image up of the actors and the family. It's, as you can see, it how they do it, it's pretty savvy. It's pretty cool. And the actors, actually, there's some resemblance. Not much, but, you know, they're actors. They're able to pull it off. Obviously, here's the real family here. And here's the actor's family, the acting family. It's a great series on Netflix. I encourage you to watch it. But just realize it's a series. It's there's no proof of none of this. It's how interviews and then with conjecture. It's always interviews with their own conjecture in there. So a lot of it is made up, especially the abuse. When I say made up, I'm not saying the abuse did not happen. I'm saying the scenes they show, how things went down. And the brothers have condemned the miniseries there, the Netflix limited series. There's also a great documentary on this as well. So because of that, there's been a resurgence, especially on platforms like TikTok. So many users are creating content and that romanticizes the story, often dressing like them, discussing their case, and it sparked discussions about the complexities of this situation, with both brothers expressing differing views on the hope and public perception because they want to get out of prison. Now, despite gaining significant support, TikTok is showing something that's ugly that's happening in our society. It's a culture shift towards understanding and discussing issues of mental health and abuse more openly. Yes. But it's also ignoring the fact there was a cold-blooded, brutal murder and their lives weren't in danger. And it just so happened if their parents were gone, they would inherit their parents' millions. So the creators, whether TikTok or documentaries or Netflix, they have a lot of power in how they share their story. So in all of the cases I bring up, there's a lot of emotional storytelling that frame the brothers' experiences as complete 100% victims, which has got TikTok and young kids wanting to get them out of jail. Here's the problem. you think it's okay to murder your parent, a person, because of child abuse, instead of going to the police and doing the right thing. Hate begets hate. I talk to my friends in the South, because when I go back and visit, I have quite a few friends who are African-American, with black friends, Latino friends. As a Latino, a whole circle was bashing the mixture. I tell them, hey, 25 deaths during the BLM riots. Society was okay with that, at least one half of society I wasn't. And I kept warning people, the chickens will come home to roost one day. And they have. The MS-13 gangs, the gangs in Aurora, the gangs in Chicago, New York City, the rates of murders happening here. Hate begets hate. Y'all looked the other way when it happened there. Now it's happening to you specifically, culturally speaking. Leftists, blacks who supported the BLM movement, you're upset that there are now Latino gangs and the Democrats in power in these urban cities aren't doing anything. Be careful what you wish for. And my whole point is saying, if you think they should get out, well, criminals recognize that. I can get out, or I'm not going to be in prison if I can claim a child abuse. All I have to do is scream that and throw that out. And it's happened in New York City, LA, Boston, Chicago. So all y'all on TikTok, on Instagram, on social media, saying not completely ignoring the parents' murder, the chickens will come home to roost. You don't know, it could be you one day, it could be somebody else. But be careful, because if there is no law and order, there is chaos, and there are ramifications towards chaos, as we now see with other illegal gangs, aliens and other illegal gangs in these urban areas. That's all I want to say on that part. So that said, there's a new hearing. The Menendez brothers, Eric and Lyle, they're set for a new resentencing hearing on November 29th, 2024, following what people say is significant. I think it's significant. I think it's convenient. But soon to be former LA County District Attorney George Gascon announced this decision amid growing public interest, fueled by the recent media portrayals and changing, as I just described, societal attitudes towards issues of abuse and justice. Now, the reasons for this new hearing, it's the new evidence that it includes a letter written by Eric to a cousin in December of 1988, which hints at sexual abuse he suffered at the hands of their father, Jose Menendez. Additionally, there is an affidavit from a former Menudo member, Roy Rosello, who alleged similar abuse by Jose Menendez. And that could be critical. My take is, why you wait till now, bro? There's been enough documentaries, enough movies, enough pleading by these people. Why wait till now? He's waiting till now because he wants attention now. That's part of the reason. You know, to me, there's issues when somebody's dead and then you speak out. They don't have a voice to defend themselves. So I have issues with that. Not in this case particularly, but just in general. But as I said, it's a sworn affidavit he filed in 2023. He stated he was raped by Jose Menendez in the early 1980s when he was 14 or 15 years old. I kind of find that hard to believe, to be quite honest. If you do it, so a lot of people, there's a lot of documentation that this stuff stays in-house, in the family, not out. But it has happened out, but you would think there would be more victims if that was the case, especially with Menudo. He made Menudo huge stars. That's just my take. I'm not saying I'm right. I could be wrong. If the evidence is there, show me the evidence. But I'm not going to take the he says, she said at face value, you know. So he claims he waited until 2023 to make these accusations because the public, due to a combination of personal and societal factors. But he gives no details. Just gives a general carte blanche. You know, it's kind of like when Democrats go, oh, you're racist, or you're misogynist, and they just say it. And then you look at them, well, hold on, I'm Latino, or I'm black, or I'm Asian. And when they lose about it, they say, well, you can be a racist too, or you're a self-loather. Yeah, one of the two. You can't win with these people. So what are the likely outcomes of this? Well, the outcome of the hearing will rest with a single judge who will assess whether the new evidence warrants a reduction or commutation of the brother's sentence. There's a potential for a retrial. That's what I like to see, is a retrial. If the judge finds sufficient grounds to change the verdict or sentencing, it could lead to a retrial. I don't think he has the power. I don't think he has the ethical morality to do a resentencing. Who is he to play God? Send it back to a jury. Because what you're doing is saying the jury and their peers did not matter the first time. You should not have that power. Again, the public perception and romanticizing of violence these people want to blur the lines between victimhood and culpability. That has ramifications. There is opposition. Kenny Menendez's brother, Milton Anderson, the brother, obviously the brother of Kenny, as I said, he strongly opposes this. He emphasized that the brothers meticulously planned and executed the killings, asserting that their actions were driven by greed rather than any claims of abuse. And I believe that. I do believe that with the way it's been portrayed, with the way how Lyle said, I'll lie on the stand. We don't know what is true anymore. We don't. We will find out. Gascon has actually appealed to Newsom to commute their sentence because he's not going to be in office. And the new district attorney incoming may try to use his influence and sway to pull it back or try to convince the judge, et cetera, et cetera. Gascon did this because he was trailing so bad. If you want to hear more about Gascon, we're going to be talking about him in this week's Fired Up episode 52. If you want to go check that out on our website or at our Grumbly's Media profile on YouTube or Rumble. So as the November hearing approaches, this will serve as a pivotal moment, not only for Eric and Lyle Menendez, but also for the broader discussions about justice, accountability, and societal perceptions. Remember BLM? Now remember Aurora, the murders, rapes in the cities right now by illegals being housed in hotels? Hate begets hate. The roosters will come home to roost. Be careful what you wish for in this decision. All right, let us move on to the death of late night TV. Late night TV profits are non-existent, which begs the question, or I'm sorry, which begs the statement to be made, go woke and go broke. So let me show you a picture of the former late night host that some people were saying are the greats of the greats. I think only one of these is the greatest, and that is Johnny Carson. That is the individual you see there on the right-hand side. And then you got David Letterman, who I did not find funny, but he was popular in his own right. And then Jay Leno, who kept this, who was the last great night host. So right now, late night TV is experiencing a significant, significant decline in profitability and viewership. The ad revenue has dropped by more than 50% since 2014. And what happened? Well, once Obama came in, late night really went woke, and they've never come back. So they've lost more than 50% of their ad revenue, with revenue ran out at $342 million over, compared to over $800 million. There's a reason the networks are dying. There's a reason we're going to streaming. When you go woke, you go broke, and that's what's happened. That is exactly what has happened. Today's late night hosts, they're all vajayjays. Every single one of them are pajama boys. I am sure their wives are probably sleeping with real men. I mean, is that really Jimmy Kimmel's baby? Well, you don't know. I'm kidding. It is. I assume it is. But these are cucks. These are vajayjays. These are girls. Just go ahead and transition and be done with it, Colbert, Kimmel, and Fallon. You know, Fallon's the worst. He's really not a liberal, but he caves to peer pressure. He wants to be liked. NBC reduced the Tonight Show starring Jimmy Fallon from 5 to 4 nights a week. ABC is considering reducing Jimmy Kimmel Live. And CBS ended the late show with after James Corden left. He was a British fat guy. He's creepy guy. I saw how he was acting all over Justin Bieber one time I saw him. I'm like, oh, dude, man, that's molestation if he'd have been a girl. You know, he's a creepy guy. Now, enter cable TV. Enter Greg Gutfeld on Fox News. He's outperforming them. Why is that significant? Easy. Late night television is on network television. That's free. Everybody gets it regardless. Even if you're streaming or even on satellite, you get those free. You can get them free somewhere. They're not going to cost you a dime. Well, it's pretty interesting. There you have it on the top. There's Jimmy Vajayjay Fallon, Kimmel on his Jimmy on his knees, Kimmel, boy toy Stephen Colbert. All three are vajayjays. All three are cucks. All three are rich. And if you're Latino or Black, they may talk a good game about how they want the best for you, but they don't. A dumb, indoctrinated fool is someone they can count on to continue their ideological beliefs. And that's why late night ratings are dropping like a rock. The guy below it, Greg Gutfeld, I don't think he's very funny, to be quite honest. I'm not a big fan of his, but he's beating them in ratings. In September 2024, Gutfeld achieved its highest rated telecast with 4.9 million viewers and 744,000 in the 25 to 54 demo. And he outperformed all other cable and broadcast shows, late night shows. For the third quarter of 2024, Gutfeld averaged 2.8 million viewers and 413,000 in the 25 to 54 demo. October 7th, 2.9 million compared to Jimmy Kimmel, 2 million. That's not even close. October 8th, 3.1 million. While the late show with Stephen the Cut Colbert had 2.9 million. In July 2024, Gutfeld attracted more Democratic viewers than Jimmy Fallon's The Tonight Show. 575,000 viewers than Jimmy Fallon's 396,000. And Jimmy Kimmel Live, 434,000. This is a guy on cable outdrawing them. That should be seen as an impossibility. August 2024, Gutfeld again averaged 2.5 million, outpacing all three of them, with only Colbert averaging 2 million. And Gutfeld probably has a nice big fat contract now, but these guys are still being paid millions more. Their end is coming. So what is the future late night television? Well, it's uncertain right now. I guess there's an individual named Bill Carter who's an expert on this. He suggests that the golden age of late night TV has passed. You think, Bill? I'm not an expert, and I could have told you that. Johnny Carson was the king of primetime. Johnny Carson kept NBC alive. NBC was just bleeding money in the late 70s, early 80s. Bleeding money. Hemorrhaging. His show was the only profitable show. He got what he wanted. They paid him like a king's ransom. Because he was bringing in, they could charge their advertisers top dollar, and it was making, offsetting what they were losing with their prime time. In their defense, there's also the shift towards digital platforms and changing viewer habits. You know, that creates new challenges. But at the end of the day, if they were funny, people would watch them. They're not funny. They're political. They hate me. They hate conservatives. I'm Latino. Yo soy Latino. Mi abuelita es una negrita y yo tengo otro que se ven el color tradicional. Yo soy el único blanquito. So they hate me because I won't conform and toe the line to what their rich whiteness wants us to. And I'm being sarcastic when I say the rich whiteness. It's a term that Democrats always throw around. But regardless, late night television to me is dead until the networks come to their senses to go back to entertaining insomniacs. And the longer they play politics and hate, the less relevant. The longer they play politics of hate, the less relevant they'll become. Because until the day we get, I'm looking at my notes. What I'm trying to say is they're going to become less and less relevant the more they play politics until eventually those time slots will go to repeats. When I was a kid, 11:30, I'd watch The Night Stalker with Kolchak. Look it up, youngsters. You can find it on streaming. That was the original. Or that was what inspired the X-Files. They used to show new shows at 11:30 back in the early 70s. Yeah. So maybe the death of late night television is just so bad if it can bring us in some low budget shows that are entertaining. We'll find out probably within the next couple of years. Who knows? Maybe they'll get a bump now that Trump got elected. You know, when the opposing party is in power, those shows on television tend to do better. So let's move on to the final topic of the night, my friends. Hollywood actor Alan Rickman passes away. As I said, you probably don't recognize him by name, but you recognize his face. This one on the bottom left is his most famous and most iconic role. and that is LA Law. This one up here is from Dharma and Gray. And those both, LA Law at the time was the rage. It was a pop culture phenom. And Dharma and Gray was a perennial top 10 hit. As you can tell, that's an older picture of him on the right there. But again, he was acclaimed for his role in LA Law and Dharma and Gray. He is dead at the age of 82 from heart failure. He played the role of Douglas Brackman Jr. He kind of, his father was one of the partners that built up the law firm, and he was kind of like the office manager. You know, the lawyer, he did law, but he ran the office. He was always seen as the bad guy. That aired from 1986 to 1994. Its first few years, probably his first 2 to 4 years, massive hits, Jimmy Smith, Harry Hamlin, Corbin Burnson. It made some big stars. And then in Dharma and Gray, this is hilarious. He played Larry Finkelstein, as stereotypical a name as you can get, Finkelstein, the laid-back father in Dharma and Gray. And that aired from 97 to 2002. So he guest starred in those 3 years in between. So that's a phenomenal run. 17 years, 16 straight years almost, earning good pay. He made his way. He did have a famous brother-in-law too. Rackins was the brother-in-law of Stephen Bacho. Rackins' wife, Joanna Frank, is Bacho's sister. Now you go, who is Stephen Bacho? Hill Street Blues, for you old-timers. It revolutionized how procedurals are done, meaning how that gritty look you get in today's TV dramas. Any drama, really, you get that gritty look. Hill Street Blues was the first show to do it like that. NYPD Blue is a very, very iconic show that broke a lot of barriers, including showing the first nudity in prime time, then showing Sipa, which is fat ass too. Ooh, they need to see that. Obviously, he also created LA Law and Doogie Howser MD, which is has transcended generations. Those were four pop cultural phenomenal shows. Pop culture meaning they impacted our culture in a way that hadn't been impacted before. Hill Street Blues brought grittiness and realism to television that had never before been seen. NYPD Blue broke barriers with the cursing, with the nudity, with the hard-hitting stories, keeping that gritty look. LA Law, that was flashy lawyers. It was just one of those shows that it hit all the targets. Not very memorable in today's day and age, I would say, but back then it was. And obviously, Doogie Howser, MD, it was a funny show. I actually never saw it. I mean, I've seen scenes from it. But it was a big pop phenomenon also. And there you have it, my friends. Alan Rackins is remembered for his significant contributions to television, particularly in the legal and comedy genres, obviously, with L.A. Law and Dharma and Gray. And he also influenced a lot of actors, a lot of character actors. They look at individuals like Alan Rackins, and they know they're not going to be a movie star. But they can be the next best thing, a character actor, somebody like him. It's one of those type of roles where us on the outside, we just see a guy that we see a lot on television. Inside the industry, well-respected, beloved. People can learn from them because more people are him than they are the Tom Cruises. Rest in peace, Alan. Godspeed and much love as you continue your next journey. And we're all going to eventually make that journey. God bless. So, the Menendez brothers, we'll have an update at the end of the month when the judge determines what's going to happen. Late night television, we'll keep an eye on that. And if it keeps trending down, we'll let you know who's going to be the first killed off. And until then, do not forget, you can find this show on grumblingsmedia.com. I also host a show called Points on the Board, which is where sports and politics collide. Colin Kaepernick made that happen. We just wrapped up and just released an episode on the San Jose State University volleyball transgender issue with them suspending, and they retaliated against an assistant coach who filed a complaint. We talked about the boxer, the Olympic boxer. The test results came back in. The one that wrestled and won the gold as a woman, well, the test results are in, and we talk about whether he's a woman or a man. And then we also debate if the NFL has a quarterback development problem. So check that episode out, Points on the Board, episode 96, I believe. And I also do a Fired Up show. I'm getting ready to shoot that here shortly. And we're going to be talking about Trump's win, California, and how it's rebelling and shooting down a lot more taxes, passing bills that toughen crime. That's a fun show, too. We try to keep that loose, too. And we're going to obviously talk about Trump's win and who is a real threat to democracy. So I urge you to check that out. Again, you can find this show and others like it at grumliesmedia.com. You can find us on our social media platforms, YouTube, Rumble, Apple, Spotify, and Pandora under the profile handle Grumlies Media. Do not forget to like, share, and most importantly, subscribe. I am William Del Pilar. This is the Red, White, and Rude. And then until next time, thank you for watching, and I bid you adieu.